Don't be shy.
Venerable, I have two questions. The first question is, how do we share the merits with departed ones?
How do we share merits with departed ones?
Okay. And because if the departed one has already rebirthed, then yeah. When we do share the merits, how does the merits go to them?
So if somebody has already passed away, how can...
We share, like for example, our parents, how do we share our gratitude to them?
Yeah, this is tricky. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, it said that when a person passes away, they don't immediately take rebirth, but they go into what's called the bardo, or intermediate state between this life and the next. And it's not sure how long that will last. It could be anywhere from one moment to 49 days. But 49 days is the maximum amount of time that one can be in the bardo. So during that, you know, within that amount of time, the person takes a new life, a new rebirth. So it's customary, also in the Chinese tradition, to recite prayers, accumulate merit, dedicate all this virtue to a person who's passed away within 49 days, right? Within 7 weeks. But then what after that? So the point is, if we do recite prayers and create merit and dedicate for the person who's passed away, there is a possibility, it's not definite, but there's a possibility that these merits, this positive energy, will help the person to find a fortunate rebirth rather than an unfortunate one. But then once they have taken rebirth, they're already in their new life, then it's more difficult to benefit them. I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, you have to forget about them and not do any more prayers and so forth. You can still do that, you know. It's also a way of expressing your gratitude and your appreciation to parents and so on who've helped us so much. So one can continue to recite prayers, dedicate merit and so on, even after the 49 days. It's just not sure if you would be able to help them or not. But there is a practice in the Tibetan tradition called Jhangwa. And they used to have it here in ABC. I don't know if they still do. But it's a practice. It needs to be done by a lama who's accomplished, who has, you know, certain abilities. But in this practice, the lama will kind of invoke the consciousness of the person who's passed away, even if they're already in another realm. Invoke their consciousness to come here, and then offer all this merit, positive energy, give them some Dharma teaching, and then tell them to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. Or it could be another Pure Land, but some Pure Land. So that is something that could be done. Even, I mean, it's good if it's done fairly soon, but one of my teachers, actually Denma Lodge Rinpoche, he came here a couple of times. He had been invited to Korea to do that practice on behalf of those who died during the Korean War, which was 1950s, early 50s. So that's like, you know, 50 or 60 years later after those people had already passed away. So again, it's not definite that that would actually do anything. I suppose it depends on so many factors: the ability of the lama, the karma of those who've passed away, and so on. But I guess the idea is that my understanding is if the person does have some seeds of virtue, some good karma in their continuum, and the Lama is doing this practice, then those two things can come together, and it could happen that the person, could go to a better place of rebirth. So it doesn't hurt. What I figure is it doesn't hurt to try. You probably wouldn't make things worse. You might be able to make things better, but it's not 100% sure.
My second question is, in our last final moments, what should we be thinking? I mean, if we're on the deathbed, what should we be thinking or contemplating?
Well, this is what I'm going to talk about this afternoon, preparing for death. So hopefully that question will get answered. And if not, we can come back to it. But it's a big question, an important question. Yeah. Any others? I think it's already on. Oh?
Your turn. Okay. Yeah, Venerable. So I'm quite, in a way, not so sure these days about making aspirations for my next rebirth, because I am not sure, should I make an aspiration to a pure abode, be it
to
a pure land, like Amitabha pure land, or maybe Padmasambhava's, the copper colored mountain, because I took empowerment with Guru Rinpoche. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or should I aspire for human rebirth in order to practice? And also I've heard that you can actually practice as a deva, actually.
Yeah.
In a certain part of the Deva heaven. So I'm honestly quite confused. I don't know what to aspire to.
I think we had this discussion a few weeks ago. Maybe you weren't here.
No, I was here. I think you said that there were two schools of thought. One was, I think you said the Lama will choose. Then the other one was, you said you have to choose.
Well, this is Jacqueline. Where's Jacqueline? Yeah. She had asked that question to Geshe Lama Khunchok, one Lama who taught here in the past. And he said, no, you have to choose, not your Lama. But then I mentioned a story where Lama Zopa Rinpoche told one student, it sounded like he kind of decided for her, which pure land. So perhaps my understanding is it depends on the teacher and their style. Whether they like to tell you or they want you to decide for yourself, I don't know. But I think it could also depend on the person, on the disciple, the student. Some people may have a very, very strong sense of certainty, of like a feeling of a connection with a particular deity, and really definite, I want to go to that Buddha's pure land. Okay, so then you know for yourself. If you don't know, and if you do have a teacher, then you could ask your teacher and just see what happens, whether they give you advice or tell you, no, you figure that out. So I don't think there's a definite way that everybody would follow. And I also mentioned the story of one Lama. He wasn't really a Lama, he was more of attendant to a Lama. And he said that he wanted to come back to this world because here there's more opportunities to feel compassion because there's so much suffering in this world. Whereas in a pure land, it's so pure and peaceful and blissful. Maybe not so many chances of generating compassion. But I would think, the Buddhas would take care of that. They would, maybe play some suffering movies, so that movies from planet Earth to show people what's going on down there, and there's still a lot of suffering down there. So, I would think that even in a pure land, there would be opportunities for you to, keep your compassion alive and develop it even further. So I don't have the answer. I'm sorry, I don't know.
So what I'm doing these days is what I think you described a few weeks ago, that just wherever is the best.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I figure, you know. I mean, I don't know what will come up in my mind at the time of death. I might feel a very strong certainty that I want to do such and such or go to such and such place. But at this point in time, I just think I leave it up to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I'll pray to them to help me go to a place that will be beneficial for me. Beneficial for me and beneficial for others. That's what I want. I mean, that's like the bottom line. I just want to make sure that I can be beneficial and not harm and continue my spiritual practice towards enlightenment. So wherever is the best place where that can happen, then may I go there. Yeah. I just remembered I heard a story. There's a famous Catholic saint, Saint Teresa of Lisieux. She lived in France during the 1800s. She died quite young. She was only 22 when she died. She had tuberculosis. But apparently she made some kind of prayer that she didn't want to go to heaven. Or no, what is it? She said, may I spend my heaven in the world, on earth, to continue helping. So she didn't want to go to heaven. She wanted to stay in this world and be able to help others. So it's kind of similar to what that Lama said, you know, I want to be here in this world. This is where there's so many opportunities for compassion and helping people and so on. And of course, there was that story about the Lama who actually wanted to go to hell. Yeah? You hear that one? He was praying that he would go to hell because he wanted to help the beings who have the greatest suffering. But then just before he died, he had a vision of the Pure Land, and he said, oh no, I want to go to hell. I don't want to go to a Pure Land. So you don't always get, it sounds like you don't always get what you wish for. Depends on your merit, your karma.
Thank you. Venerable, this morning you mentioned about death being impermanent, it's changing. So babies are born and sometimes they die at the time of birth. So it sounds as though, you know, even before they've had a chance to acquire merit or do anything, their karma meter sort of runs out and they pass from this life. So it sounds as though it's not that indefinite in the sense that it's all kind of laid out, that there is a karmic, karma meter, I call it, that kind of, you know,
a
karmic meter or something that keeps rolling and ticking. And as we acquire merit, maybe we prolong life. And if we do harm, maybe, you know, it might just ripen this lifetime. So maybe it's not that indefinite. And it's within our control. And I guess my question is, so knowing all this impermanence, and working on our spiritual life, that is of prime importance, how do we benefit other beings in our own pursuit of spiritual development? Does it?
Well, I guess I got a little caught up thinking about your question about karma, because I was thinking there is a teaching, I can't quite remember how it goes, but they say that the reason death happens, or when it happens, one reason or one cause is you have a certain amount of karma to be in this life, and then when that karma finishes, you die. So in the case of a baby, for example, that might be the case. The baby only had that much karma to be in this life, and then it expired. But another cause is you might actually have the karma to live longer, but some other karma might ripen that would cause, for example, a karma to be in a car accident or a plane crash or something like that. So you know, it's like some other karma has interrupted the first karma. Another explanation is, or another reason is, that you may have the karma to live longer, but the conditions are not there for that to happen. For example, a famine. Okay, when there's a famine, there just isn't sufficient food to sustain your life. So you might actually have karma to live longer, but the conditions are not there. Contributory conditions for life have run out. Something like that. So there are different ways that life can come to an end, but yeah, they're all related to karma in some way. So then I didn't quite understand the last question that you asked. Something about benefiting others.
Yeah, so if you talk about the first priority to use this limited life that we have, body and a mental awareness, those faculties, to pursue a spiritual life, if that's of prime importance of having this body. And if we go along that pursuit, at what point do we actually benefit someone? It seems as though we would be trudging along our own path, mm-hmm. But how does that benefit other sentient beings?
I mean, there's lots of ways we can benefit others, but it would depend on our own our knowledge and our qualities, the qualities that we either have from past lives or that we develop in this life. I mean, benefiting others can mean, you know, giving them food, whatever they need, giving them comfort when they're frightened or depressed. You know, there's lots of ways, even just being kind and friendly. You know, those are beneficial things to do for others. And then on top of that, if one has learned some spiritual teachings, to the extent that you can share those with others, then you can also do that. You can teach them Dharma if they're interested. We're not supposed to push Dharma onto people. But if they wish to learn, they want to learn, then to share with others. So, and then, of course, if you're mind is developed even further, then you can help others, you know, in even greater ways. So there's lots of ways we can benefit others.
I guess that's assuming that we're integrated. So I was like thinking, okay, which is the accelerated path? Then go off to a forest and do some deep meditation, and then there you're in isolation. So if you're on this path, how would you possibly benefit others if you're living in the forest and kind of, you know, isolated?
Well, this is what some people choose to do. They choose to focus on their own practice and meditation. And so they would stay in an isolated place and practice full time. And yeah, it's questionable how that is beneficial for others. But, you know, I've heard that there are people who do healing, and they can do it from the distance healing, meaning you don't have to be physically present in order to help the other person. You can just mentally do the healing and send it to the other person, and it can actually benefit them even if they're on the other side of the world. So if that is possible, then I think a person sitting alone in a cave or in the forest meditating and sending out, you know, their loving kindness and compassion to others would be able to benefit them. So that's one thing they could do. And then, of course, if they are really working on themselves, developing their minds, and if they do actually attain higher levels of realization, even in this lifetime, they may not be going out and interacting with other people. But in the next life and subsequent lives, they, because of this energy that they created in their previous life, then they would be enacting that. I think of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for example, the spiritual director of our center here. In his previous life, he spent most of his time in the cave meditating. He didn't go out much, he didn't see many people. But he had this amazing compassion and wish to benefit others, and he was constantly making prayers to be able to benefit others. And look what he's doing in this lifetime. I mean, he's just going all over the world and helping so many people with Dharma, with spiritual teachings, and so forth. So the cause was created in previous lives, and the result is happening in this life. So that's another way one could understand that staying in a more isolated situation can be beneficial to others. But, you know, even in a cave, you have animals, insects, you know, there's always sentient beings, ghosts, spirits. So there's sentient beings around that you can benefit. So it doesn't mean you have to be connecting with everybody and benefiting everybody. There's always some sentient beings around that you can help and benefit. The important thing is to have a sincere wish to do that, and then whenever you have the opportunity to do so, to do it. So maybe we continue, and if there are other questions that come up later, we can take care of them. Okay, so we left off at this point of what is beneficial, what will benefit us at the time of death. And in this meditation, it says that, you know, it's not necessarily the case that our family and friends will be able to help us at the time of death. They might be able to give a certain amount of help, but, you know, even the fact that they can't go with us, you know, they can't accompany us through the whole process of dying and into the next life. I mean, that itself shows that what help they can give is quite limited. And also, even if they are there, they may not be in the right state of mind to be able to give us help. I saw that a few times when I was here in Singapore in the 90s, and somebody would be dying and I'd be asked to go to the hospital to recite prayers. And I sometimes observed that the relatives of the person who was dying were emotionally overwhelmed by what was going on, their own sadness, which is of course understandable. There's sadness and fear and anxiety and so on and so forth. So they weren't really in a state of mind to be able to give comfort and spiritual help to the person who's dying. I mean, the best person to be there would be your spiritual teacher, if possible. Yeah, someone who has a lot of knowledge and experience and a very calm, peaceful state of mind, and would be able to be there and say prayers for you and so on. So that kind of person, if you can have them there with you when you're dying, that would be fantastic. But ordinary relatives and friends, you know, they might be just too upset to be able to give help. So, and then our possessions, wealth, and so forth, you know, if we have a lot of money, then we can have a nice private room in the hospital and, you know, maybe 24-hour care. But, you know, beyond that, when we're actually dying and passing from this life to the next, all our wealth and material things won't be of much use because we can't take any of it with us. Also, there's the danger of attachment. You know, if you have a lot of attachment to your money, your property, your things, that makes it difficult to have a peaceful death. Yeah. In fact, one of my teachers said it's really good to make sure you make a will before you die. And you know, since we don't know when death's going to happen, it could be, it's good to do it any time, even if you're 20. But you have material things. It's good to make a will to ensure that you've already decided what will happen with your money, your property, and so on. So then as you're dying, you don't have to be worrying about that. That's already been taken care of. Just during the break, Jan was telling me that the Singapore government last year had this sort of campaign encouraging people to prepare for death. Is that right? So that's probably what they were talking about, right? Making a will and power of attorney and just making the practical decisions that should be done before you die. That's very, very wise to do that so that then that doesn't become an additional worry and concern as you're dying. And then our body, again, that is something we have to leave behind. So if we have a lot of attachment to our body and we identify with our body, this is me, then those kind of attitudes will make it difficult for us to die peacefully. I mean, according to Buddhism, the most important thing, and this is partly related to this question earlier, the most important thing is to have a peaceful and positive state of mind as we die. Okay? And that means a state of mind as much as possible, free of attachment, clinging, grasping, free of anger, hatred. And that's another thing that can happen, you know, when people die because of, you know, I mean, you don't like what's going on, right? You don't feel happy with what's happening. And sometimes people are very angry, angry that they're sick, angry that they're dying. And then that anger can be thrown out at everybody, your doctors and nurses and your family and everybody who comes to visit you. So I've heard of that. I've heard of people dying in a very angry state of mind. And that would be very, very unfortunate because according to Buddhism, what determines our next life, where we are born and what experiences we will have is mainly our karma. So we have a lot of karma. We create a lot of karma in our life. Some of it may be good, some of it may be bad. We also have karma we brought with us from past lives. So we have this big collection of different kinds of karma. So that's one factor, but a very important factor is the state of mind at the time of death. That state of mind will be an important condition determining which of the many different kinds of karma that we have will ripen and be the cause for our next rebirth. So if we can die with a positive state of mind, for example, feeling love, compassion, or feeling, if you're, you know, a devotional person, feeling devotion, faith to the Buddha, to your teacher, to, you know, objects of refuge. So those are just some examples of positive states of mind, virtuous states of mind. So a virtuous state of mind at the time of death will be the catalyst for one of our good karmic seeds to come to the forefront and then be the karma that will cause our next rebirth. And it will be a good rebirth, a good situation. On the other hand, if we're in a negative state of mind, negative can mean anger, attachment, grasping, craving. So if the state of mind is negative, then that is the catalyst for one of the negative karmic seeds to come to the forefront and be the cause for the next rebirth. So the state of mind at the time of death is very, very crucial for determining the next life, the next rebirth, and where we will be, what experiences we will have, and so on. So from that point of view, the most important thing is having a positive state of mind at that time. So that's why it's said to be so important to engage in Dharma practice, spiritual practice, to be able to have a positive state of mind. And it seems that other religions and spiritual traditions have a similar idea, because once when I was here before in the 90s, I was invited to a seminar at one of the hospices, maybe Dover Park Hospice. They were holding a seminar for their volunteers who were, of course, working with dying people. And they invited representatives of the different religions, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, to come and talk about how we understand death and what's important for someone who's dying, so that the volunteers then, when they're working with people of different religions, would have some knowledge of what's important in helping the dying patient. And what struck me was, so I was talking from the Buddhist point of view, but I listened to the other talks as well, and it struck me that we were all basically saying the same thing, you know, that the important thing is to help the dying person have a positive, peaceful state of mind, not be clinging to this life, not be afraid of death, not be worried about what's going to happen to them, but feel, you know, everything's going to be okay. So I thought that was really interesting, you know, that was a theme, a universal theme amongst all these religions. So that's the most important thing, to be able to have a positive state of mind at the time of death, and to be able to have a positive state of mind at the time of death, we have to learn how to do that now. How to have a positive state of mind and how to deal with negative states of mind so that we don't get totally caught up and out of control with the negative states of mind. So basically that's the meaning of Dharma. Dharma is really, if we put it in a nutshell, Dharma is all about working with our mind and learning to manage our mind so that we can keep our mind positive as much as possible. And when it comes to negative states of mind like anger and so on, learning how to manage those and transform the mind from negative into positive. So if we can, you know, get experience in that during our life, get good at that during our life, then we'll be able to do that at the time of death. That makes sense? So that's why it's said that what will help us at the time of death is Dharma, meaning spiritual practice. And again, it doesn't have to be Buddhist, because all religions and spiritual traditions have spiritual practices that can help the mind be in a good state, calm, peaceful, positive, virtuous. Okay, so now let's go on. Okay, so I wanted to share with you something from a really good book. You can find the reference in here, in this little booklet. Yeah, it's on page 52, where there are recommended reading books. So halfway down, a book called Facing Death and Finding Hope by Christine Longacre. She's an American woman who began working with dying people after her husband passed away. I think she must have been in her early 20s or mid-20s when that happened, because her husband was only 25 and they had a one-year-old child. So that's pretty young to lose a husband, and I think it was pretty hard for her. But after that, she began working in hospices with other dying people. So she had a lot of experience working with dying people when she wrote this book. And she also was a student of Tibetan Buddhism. But in the book, she doesn't really talk so much about that. It's more like she takes Buddhist ideas but puts them into ordinary language that anybody could relate to. So, yeah, the book is called Facing Death and Finding Hope. And so much of the book is related to what she calls the four tasks of living and dying. So I'm just going to briefly mention these, and if you want to know more, you can have a look at her book. So the first is called Understanding and Transforming Suffering. Because at the time of death, it's quite possible that there will be suffering. There could be physical suffering. And even if there isn't much pain, but just, you know, the body becoming weaker and weaker and less able to do the things we normally do, you know, it's that itself can be quite challenging. So there may be physical suffering, and there may also be mental suffering as we're, you know, getting to the end of our life. There's most probably sadness about leaving behind our loved ones and so forth. So most people will have to face suffering at the time of death. And if we've never learned how to deal with suffering, then we might find it overwhelming and, you know, be unable to manage all this suffering, become, again, depressed or angry or, you know, experience other difficult states of mind. So her advice is that before we reach that point, while we're still alive, to learn how to deal with suffering rather than always running away from it, trying to avoid it, immediately taking painkillers, you know, so we don't have to experience even a moment of pain. So it's good to learn how to manage suffering. And there's a whole body of material in the Tibetan tradition about this, about how to manage suffering. For example, there's a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche called Transforming Suffering. It's Transforming Suffering into Happiness. That sounds pretty wild, but it is possible. You know, the point is, we can't avoid suffering in life. Nobody can go through life and every single day, every single moment, you're happy and blissful and you don't have any problems. It's impossible. Everybody faces problems. Everyone encounters problems in life, both physical and mental. And but depending on our mind, depending on our attitude, it doesn't necessarily have to be so bad. We can learn to manage difficulties, problems, even pain. The whole point of these teachings is transforming them into the path, using suffering, using difficulties as part of the path. Actually, this is what I was talking about two weekends ago, a whole weekend about mind training and how to work with suffering. So there's lots of different tools or methods or techniques that one can use. One of my favorites is compassion, using your own experiences of suffering to understand the suffering of others and increase your compassion, feel more compassion for others. So a simple way of doing that is, you know, when you're having a problem, to remind yourself that you're not the only person in the world who has a problem like this. Lots of other people, even at the same moment that you are having this problem, lots of other people are having this kind of problem too. So then you can think, well, now I understand what it's like, what they're going through. Just as I don't like this problem, it's difficult for me, it's also difficult for them. So that helps you to have empathy, empathy for others, understanding their difficulties. And then the next step is compassion, which is wishing them to be free of their suffering. So even if you just say that to yourself, even if it's hard to really feel it, but even to just say the words, you know, how nice it would be if nobody had to go through this problem, if everybody could be free from this problem. So that's using a problem to have more compassion. And so compassion is a very important part of the spiritual path. It's also a very positive state of mind. Scientists have done research on compassion and found all these benefits of compassion. Relieves your stress, it makes you happier, you live longer, and so on. So it's a really beneficial state of mind. So you can use a problem to have more compassion. So this is an example of transforming suffering into the spiritual path and also into happiness. Also, one benefit of this is when we ourselves are going through some problem or difficulty, what can happen, there may be this tendency to sort of get self-absorbed. Oh, poor me. Oh, isn't this terrible? Oh, I'm suffering so much. So you're kind of focused on yourself and your problem and maybe some self-pity, obsession. And doing that, I mean, not that we do it deliberately, I think it's just an automatic habit of the mind, but if that happens, it actually makes things worse. It makes the problem worse. We have this expression in English, making a mountain out of a molehill. Because you're obsessing so much about your problem, my problem, then it can seem to grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it can seem much bigger and much worse than it really is. And then you feel worse about it, right? You feel like you're kind of buried under this huge mountain-like problem. So instead of helping you feel better, it makes you feel worse. Does that make sense? Have you ever noticed that happening? But this other technique, you know, instead of obsessing about your problem, thinking about the problems of others, other people have problems too, you might even realize that your problem is actually quite small compared to what others are going through. Yeah, some people have much worse problems, much bigger problems than yours. So that itself is beneficial, as then your problem will seem more like a molehill, you know, a little mound instead of a huge mountain. And when you see it that way, then it can seem more manageable. You can feel, oh, this isn't so bad. I can manage this. Yeah. So then you feel like you're on top of the problem instead of the problem being on top of you. Does that make sense? There's a shift there, which can be really, really helpful. And then also using the problem to have compassion. Compassion is a really beautiful and positive state of mind. So you're switching yourself into a positive state of mind instead of this negative, poor me, you know, I'm suffering so much. That's not a very positive state of mind. I mean, this doesn't mean we shouldn't care about ourselves. It doesn't mean, you know, we should put ourselves down or not have compassion for ourselves. We should have compassion for ourselves. But if we really do have compassion for ourselves, then we should do something that alleviates our suffering rather than makes it worse. Doesn't that make sense? Right? And so is it compassionate to yourself to let yourself drown in suffering and obsess about your suffering? Is that effective? Is that helpful? So if you can see that, no, it's actually not. And thinking about others and generating compassion for others will actually make you feel better, then isn't that being more compassionate to yourself, more kind to yourself? So this is what the Dalai Lama calls, I guess it's like he talks about wise selfishness. Yeah, if you're going to be selfish, at least be wise about it. Don't be stupid about it. Don't be. I mean, you know, if you want happiness for yourself, if you want to take care of yourself and make yourself happy, then do it in a wise way. And that means open up your heart to others, care about others, have kindness and compassion for others, because that is the best way for yourself to be happy, to relieve your own unhappiness and help yourself to be more happy. So anyway, I'm just going blah, blah, blah. But the point I'm trying to make is there are methods for working with suffering, problems, difficulties that happen in our life. And if we get practice in this, if we learn how to do this during our life, then when it comes to the end of our life, where we'll probably be facing the biggest problems, the biggest challenges we've ever had in our life, we've already got some experience under our belt that we'll be able to use. Does that make sense? So that's my understanding of that point. Learn how to manage suffering and difficulties and even transform it into positive things during your life, so that you'll be able to do that at the time of death. Then the next point, making a connection, healing relationships, and letting go. So this is related to our relationships with others. Because sometimes with family members or friends or ex-friends, we may have damaged relationships. There may be anger, hurt, other kinds of disturbing emotions, negative emotions. And it's good to try to heal these before we die. Otherwise, at the time of death, the thoughts about these or feelings about these might come up and make it difficult for us to die peacefully. Let's just say, for example, maybe you have this conflict with one of your parents, with your mother or your father, and it's been going on for years and years and years and years, and you never really dealt with it. You might be holding on to anger, resentment, and so on towards that person. And maybe you haven't even talked to them for years. I hear about stories like that, which it's understandable in some ways, but it's also very sad. So if at the time of your death you didn't do anything, even to try to heal that relationship, thoughts and feelings and memories may come up about that, and your mind might get flooded with all these feelings, anger, resentment, and so on and so forth. And that would make it difficult to die peacefully and be in a positive state of mind at the time of death. You may also feel regret. You may feel, oh, you know, I did this and I said that and I shouldn't have. Now I realize, you know, how much I hurt them and so on and so on. But it may not be possible at that time to communicate with the other person. They may be far away, or maybe they've already died. So these sort of problems or conflicts in relationships, especially with important people like parents and siblings and children and so on, these problems could make our mind very disturbed in turmoil at the time of death. So it's best to try to heal those while we're still alive, and then be able to have a clear state of mind at the time of death. Does that make sense? And even if we do, you know, of course we always want to get along with people and not have problems and conflicts, but, you know, things do happen. Sometimes a person will do something or say something and we get angry at them. But even if that happens, it's good to try to take care of that as quickly as possible and don't let it drag on. Yeah? Does that make sense? So that, because I heard this story, which is very, it's like a really striking example of what can happen. A mother and her son had an argument just before the son left home to go on a fishing trip with his father. And so the mother and the son were angry at each other, and then they didn't clear this up before the son left. And then he didn't come home again because there was an accident on the fishing trip and the son died. So that means the last communication, the last interaction between the mother and the son was an angry one. And they were angry at each other. And I can imagine she must have felt just horrible. I mean, it's hard enough to lose a child, to lose, you know, your son, but then, you know, to have this anger in the mind. That was the last experience they had with each other. So she must have felt really, really bad, really, regret that she was angry at her son and didn't make up for that and hug him and say, I love you, and like that before he died. So this is something that could happen to any of us. If we have an argument with somebody and then we separate, go separate ways, it's not definite we'll meet again, right? It's not definite. Something could happen to the other person. Something could happen to us. So if you are aware of how bad you would feel if you didn't have a chance to clear up this argument, this conflict before death happens, then do something about it right away. Make sure you, you know, say, I'm sorry, let's make up, I didn't mean it, whatever. Whatever you can to clear things up. Although that's not always so easy to do, because sometimes the other person doesn't want to talk to you. They might be so angry at you, and even if you try to communicate with them and, you know, clear up the problem, they may not want to have anything to do with you. They don't want to have any communication. So what do you do then? I think you can still, in your own mind, you know, you can go through in your own mind what happened and try to work out, you know, forgiveness, compassion, letting go of your anger. I mean, it may take years to do that. It's not always easy to do, but it's worth it. It's worth it to be able to clear that up and let go of those negative feelings in your own mind. And then even if the other person's still angry at you, at least you have, you know, cleared up your feelings towards them as much as you can. Yeah. So I think you can still work on your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, without necessarily having to do it in communication with the other person. Does that make sense? Maybe not easy, but it's worth it. I think it's really, really worth it. Because I can say that for myself, my own experience. I had problems with my parents when I was young, which is very typical in America. And then when I started learning Buddhism and practicing Buddhism, you know, I really wanted to work on that. Because in fact, actually my teacher, Lama Yeshe, one of my teachers, he once said that if we have problems with our parents or one of our parents and we don't try to clear those problems up, we will not make progress in our spiritual practice. And I really, that really struck me. And I think it's true. I think it's true. We can't just put that aside and forget it and ignore it and meditate and do well in our meditation. It doesn't work. So I really worked hard. And of course, Buddhism helped, meditation helped to work on my relationship with my parents. And I was able to get to the point where we were on good terms, and I was able to, you know, feel good towards them. And I'm really glad I did that before they passed away, because I think I would feel really, really bad if they had passed away and I was still angry at them and hadn't cleared that up. So don't wait. You never know when someone's going to pass away. So really try to take care of those things as soon as possible. Also karmically, yeah, that's another thing, you know. We have karmic connection with people, and if there's a bad karma between us and somebody else, like if you're angry at them and they're angry at you and you've said some hurtful things or done hurtful things to each other, and you didn't try to clear that up, it's going to come up again next life or some other life. So if you don't finish it in this life, it's gonna appear in some other life. So it's much better to try to make relationships as positive as possible in this lifetime. And then number three is preparing spiritually for death. And I'm going to elaborate on that in the next couple of slides. But basically it means doing some kind of spiritual practice, having some kind of spiritual practice that we can use at the time of death that will help us to be in a positive state of mind. Just as an example, there's an American, he's passed away now, Stephen Levine. He was a meditator, and he also did a lot of work with dying people and wrote a number of books about that. And in one of his books, he mentioned that in some of the Native American traditions, there was something called a death chant. It was like a mantra, I guess. So members of this Indian tribe, would be taught the death chant when they became adolescents. And they were, you know, they had to learn it and then and recite it. And they would recite it at times when they were afraid. For example, if they were out in the wilderness and they met a wild animal or they were alone and just got really scared. So at times of fear or danger, they would recite this chant to help their minds stay calm and peaceful. But the real purpose of the chant was to use at the time of death, when they were dying, to focus their mind on something rather than let it be carried away with fear and so on. And in that way, they would be able to move through the process of dying with a peaceful state of mind. So that's the idea of a spiritual practice. A spiritual practice is something we can use as we are dying to be able to remain calm and peaceful no matter what's going on, even if there's pain, even if there's fear. That would, yeah, just help us get through that experience. And there's different kinds of practices. I'll go through some examples later. But just to mention the fourth task, and this is finding meaning in life. So she said in the book that sometimes people don't have a clear sense of what is the meaning or purpose of life. You know, why am I here? Sometimes people just go through life doing the things they're supposed to do, going to school and graduating, getting a degree, getting a job, working, you know, making money, buying a house, buying a car, but they never really think about or answer this question. What's it all about? What's the purpose of life? What's the meaning of life? And this can become problematic when they get to the end of their life, even before they get to the end. Maybe you're getting older and you're not working anymore and the kids have all left home and maybe even your spouse has passed away. So your life really goes through some big changes and your health isn't good, you're not feeling good and so on. So you might start feeling, what's this all about? Why am I here? What's the purpose of life? And that kind of doubt and questioning can cause some people to become depressed, in despair, maybe even suicidal. So her recommendation is don't wait till the end to answer this question, but you know, come to some understanding that works for you. You know, I mean, there's different ways of explaining why are we here, what is the purpose of life, but find some answer to that question that works for you, that's right for you. So in Buddhism, you know, we say that the purpose of life, well, different reason, different things. The purpose of life is to create virtue, do good, help others, try to refrain from doing harmful things, develop our spiritual potential, try to reach nirvana, try to reach enlightenment. So these are the answers to that question from the Buddhist point of view. Doing those things as much as possible. But every other religion, every other philosophy, tradition would have another explanation. But you can also just come up with your own explanation of what is the purpose of your life. Why am I here? What's important? What's meaningful? Oh, any questions about these before I go on? Like I say, I'm just covering these briefly, but in this book by Christine Longacre, she has, you know, a lot of explanation about each of these and what they mean and how to deal with them, how to work with them. But she says, if we can work with these, that during our life, this will be beneficial both for our life and for the time of dying. Help us die peacefully. You want a break? 5 minutes. 5 minutes break. Speakers. There was myself and a Christian pastor and a Muslim, a woman actually from Islam, and a Hindu teacher. We were just asked to talk about how death is viewed in our religion, how we understand
the
death.
Views on the death process.
Well, not so much. Yeah, but I think the most important thing is what is important for the person who belongs to that religion at the time of death. If you're, for example, volunteer, so let's say there's a volunteer who's helping a Buddhist while they're dying, what do they need to keep in mind and help, you know, help the person with? So I think it was like more from that point of view. So, yeah.
Because I'm conscious about not to touch something sensitive that might.
Well, that's actually I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. Tomorrow is how to help. I don't know if you're here or not, but yeah, if you're with someone who's dying, what to do, what not to do. Like, yeah. So first, I wanted to focus more on ourselves, how we, what we can do to prepare for dying, and then, I mean, chronologically, it's the other way. Probably find ourselves with dying people before we ourselves are dying. But I feel that if we haven't done anything ourselves for death, then our ability to help others will be limited. So that's why I'm doing it this way. We can learn about how to manage death for ourselves, then it's easier to help others. So I will talk about that tomorrow. If you, I don't know if you're able to come, but there is also a section.
Yeah,
I'm
actually
going to
miss tomorrow.
Oh, you're going to miss it. Yeah. Well, there's a whole section in the book. This section, helping others who are dying.
Right.
But basically, it's what I said just now, that trying to help the person have a positive state of mind. But you know, we can't force that. We can't change somebody else's them, but there are do's and don'ts, you know, like don't push the person. If you can stay calm and peaceful and positive and kind and so on, then there's a greater chance that the other person will be in that state of mind. If you're anxious, if you're angry, then you know that can influence them to be that way. So, and be sensitive to their beliefs and practices, whatever practices they may have had before, and be respectful of those. And, you know, those are just a few things that come to mind. I haven't had a whole lot of experience with dying people, but that's a few things that I've learned.
And are you the one who, because we listen to a lot of audio on the Discovering Buddhism, the meditation.
Where are you from?
Wagga Wagga, small town.
Which state is that in?
New South Wales.
Okay. Wagga Wagga.
we just started a study group, a very small one.
FPNTS in Wagga Wagga.
Very small one. Potowa.
Okay. That's good.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi.
See you. Yeah. Can you tell us something about Powa? How to do a Powa at a time of death? I understand it's important a lot. Tibetan Powa. Do I need a Rinpoche to do it, or can I do it myself, a simplified version?
Well, strictly speaking, you have to have an initiation to do Powa, and then you have to practice it. You have to do like a retreat and practice it. So you can't just do Powa if you haven't gone through that. No, you need initiation. So the other thing you could do would be to ask a lama or some practitioner to do a Powa.
Is it absolutely necessary to do a Powa, or just having a positive state of mind is good enough, right?
Well, it's not necessary to do Powa. There's other things that one can do. I'm going to talk about those.
Powa, how the transfers of death. I have a very vague idea about that.
Yeah, well, maybe it'll come up later. You know, it's too big a topic to talk about right now, but during the session, it'll come up.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Bajic.
You have to go?
No, I'm staying behind.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the rest of the time today, I'll start talking about some specific things we can do to prepare ourselves for death, so we ourselves will be more prepared for death. And then when I finish this today or tomorrow, then I'll talk about helping others who are dying. So in terms of chronology, chronologically, we will probably find ourselves dealing with the deaths of others before we ourselves die. But the reason I'm talking about it in this way is because if we do want to help others, who are dying, I think we'll be able to help others more effectively if we have done some of this work ourselves, if we have worked on, you know, dealing with our own death and preparing ourselves for our own death, and then we'll be more effective in helping others. Okay, so I'm going to go through a number of different things, and some of these, it may be that not all of these apply to you or you feel interested in, but hopefully at least one or two will be something you'd like to do. So I'm going to start with ethics, living ethically. Basically what that means, in according to Buddhism, but it's probably not so different than other religious and spiritual traditions, is just trying to avoid harming others. Like we have in Christianity, they talk about the golden rule, you know, do to others what you would want them to do to you, something like that. Don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you. So, you know, just as we want to be treated with kindness and respect and consideration, so do others. Just as we don't want anyone to hurt us, so do others. So, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, the lamas are always saying, everybody wants to be happy, everybody wants to be free of suffering. So just having that awareness, that understanding that nobody wants to be hurt. Nobody wants to be treated badly. Everybody wants to be treated with kindness, consideration, gentleness, and so on. So with that awareness, then living our life in such a way that we try to help others as much as we can, and even if we can't help them, at least try not to harm them. And in Buddhism, this applies not only to human beings, but to all living beings, animals, birds, fish, even insects. Yeah, so we try as much as we can. It's not always possible, but we try as much as we can to avoid consciously, deliberately doing anything harmful to others and try to help them as much as we can. So how does this help at the time of death? So again, the most important thing to keep in mind, or to work towards for our own death, is to be able to have a positive state of mind. A state of mind that's free of anger, free of greed, and selfishness, and kind and loving and so on to others. So if during our life we try our very best to keep our mind positive and to keep our behavior towards others positive, then there's a greater chance, because of that familiarity, that's like our habit, that's our tendency, there's a greater chance that will be in that frame of mind at the time of death. And again, mentioning my mother, an example of my mother, I think the reason she was able to be so calm and peaceful and positive at the time of death was because she'd been that way most of her life. I mean, I'm not saying she was perfect and never got angry, but I think most of the time she really was concerned about others and putting others before herself, her husband, her children. Really kind and caring and considerate and not selfish, not so selfish. So I think if we live our life with that kind of attitude and that way of being and that way of behaving with others and so on, there's a greater chance that that's the frame of mind we'll have at the time of death. On the other hand, if you make a habit of being angry and always complaining and blaming and hurting others and so on and so on, then that's the state of mind that'll probably come up at the time of death. That makes sense? Also, it's said that sometimes before dying, people can have certain experiences, sometimes visions or I don't know what to call them, but you know, things happening in their mind. And these can sometimes be painful or, frightening and so on. disturbing, very disturbing. I witnessed this with one woman. I didn't know her very well, but I was asked to go to the hospital, and she was just like tossing and turning and obviously experiencing something that was really disturbing and frightening. And we tried to talk to her, but she was just in her own world. And fortunately, she passed through that phase and calmed down before she died. But, you know, it'd be really not good to die in that state of mind. So it said that these kind of disturbing or frightening experiences at the time of death, or afterwards, it can also occur in the bardo, the intermediate state of the next life. These are the result of negative actions, harmful, unwise, unskillful actions motivated by anger, by greed, and so on and so forth. So if we do a lot of those during our life, there's a greater chance that they would cause these unpleasant experiences before we die and as we die and so forth. On the other hand, if we're more inclined towards kindness and compassion and helpfulness and so on, virtuous states of mind, virtuous ways of behaving, then those will cause pleasant experiences as we're dying. So the way we live will affect the way we die. So that's why it's important to live ethically. And I know not everybody believes in rebirth and another life after this one, but I think even if you don't believe in rebirth, even if you think everything ends at the time of death, still I'm sure you wish to have a peaceful death, a dignified death, positive death, rather than being, you know, full of fear and pain and so forth. So to be able to have a peaceful, a good death, then again it's important to live your life in a positive way, in a good way. So that's why living ethically is a good preparation for death, whether you believe in another life after this one, or this is the only life. Okay, another thing we can do to prepare for death is meditation, practice meditation. And there's lots of different kinds of meditation, so you can take your pick. Mindfulness, calm abiding, metta, loving kindness. Meditation helps us to work on our mind, to work on having our mind more calm and peaceful rather than crazy and out of control. So I think that makes sense, but that's easy to see how that connects with death and dying, because at the time of death, if we've never learned how to manage our mind, how to manage our thoughts and our emotions, then it's quite possible that our mind could be overwhelmed with, you know, disturbing thoughts, emotions, and if we haven't learned how to manage that, then it'll be difficult. So even a simple, relatively simple technique like mindfulness, learning mindfulness, even if you just practice 10 minutes a day or 15 minutes a day or whatever, with that practice you learn how to manage your mind. You learn how to be able to notice thoughts and emotions coming and going without reacting to them, without following them, but learning how to let them come and let them go, similar to clouds in the sky. So if you practice that during your life, even if you can't do it every single day, but, you know, at least a few times a week, get some experience in mindfulness practice, then that will help you to manage the mind better, at least than someone who's never practiced meditation. going through this experience of death and dying. And again, it doesn't have to be you know, Buddhist meditation. There are meditative practices, even if they don't use the word meditation, but practices in all traditions. For example, in Christianity, there's a practice of using the name of Jesus or the name of God or some kind of phrase like that that you repeat again and again. It's something to focus your mind on, keep your mind calm and still and focused rather than wild, crazy, all over the place. So depending on your propensities, the kind of things you are most attracted to and comfortable with, you can find some kind of practice that would enable you to be more prepared for death when it happens. Okay, so another useful thing to prepare for death is cultivating loving kindness and compassion. So loving kindness, or metta in Pali, is wishing happiness for others, wishing others to have happiness. Compassion is wishing others to be free of suffering. So these are natural qualities, natural states of mind that we already have. They already come up in our mind, at least sometimes with some people. For example, our loved ones, especially if you're a parent or a pet owner. You know, when you have a child or a pet that, you know, needs a lot of attention and love and care and so forth. So in relation to them, you feel this love, you want them to be happy, you want to make sure they have food to eat, you want them to not suffer, you know, not let them be hungry and cold and so forth. So we have these feelings, these states of mind coming up naturally in certain relationships with others. But in Buddhism, we have practices or methods for cultivating these states of mind, growing them so that we can feel them for more people and beings and have them more often. So working on these, cultivating more loving kindness and more compassion, this will be very helpful at the time of death, because it helps us to avoid getting caught up in negative states of mind, anger. Loving kindness and compassion are the opposite to anger and hatred. So if we're more familiar with loving kindness and compassion, there's less chance that our mind would be kind of taken over by anger and hatred, which would be very unfortunate states of mind. And also, they're just naturally beneficial. So like I mentioned before, I've heard that in the West, like in America, scientists have done studies on mainly compassion. We've done quite a bit of research into compassion and found many benefits, both for our body and mind, benefits of compassion. So the more we are able to feel compassion, fill our minds with compassion, experience compassion, then naturally we'll be happier and our well-being will be greater. So this photograph is of a man named Maury Schwartz, I think his name is. There's a book called Tuesdays with Maury, and they made it into a movie as well, which you can watch online. YouTube has it for free. It's a beautiful story, really, really, really beautiful, true story. So this man was a professor of sociology in an American university, and he contracted, what was the name of that disease? Lou Gehrig's disease, I think, ALS. Anyway, something that gradually causes your body to become paralyzed. So it started with his feet, and then it was gradually working up So, of course, he had to stop working, and then, you know, he was becoming more and more handicapped and incapacitated. But he was amazingly positive. I mean, that was the way he'd been, you know, all during his career as a professor. You know, he's really kind and compassionate and caring and joyful and positive. You know, so he continued being that way even during his illness. And one of his former students, what's his name, Mitch? Anyway, you can look it up. He had become a sports writer, I think. And so he had experience writing. And he heard about what had happened to his former professor, and he came for a visit, met with him. And then they decided to collaborate on a book. So every Tuesday, this guy would come and visit Maury, and they would have a talk about different things, the big questions of life, you know, love and relationships and kids and death and all of these things. So Mitch would write it all down, and then he made it into a book. That's the book, Tuesdays with Maury, which is really, really beautiful. It became a bestseller. But yeah, he was just amazing. His kindness, his compassion, even though he himself was so ill and was dying, you know, he showed more concern for others than for himself, and he gave this so much energy out to others. So it's a good illustration of how if we can familiarize ourselves with these qualities, which we can, you know, we can work on it during our life, learn to be more kind and compassionate to others. If we practice that during our life, it'll be easier when we're dying to have those states of mind, kindness and compassion. And that'll be good for us because they're good states of mind for ourselves, but also good for the people around us. I mean, I'm sure we don't want the people around us as we're dying to be miserable. You know, we don't want to make them unhappy by yelling at them or being depressed, and then they become depressed too. I'm sure we want to give good energy to them, make things good for them. And it is possible. It is possible. He's an example of this. So the way to do it is by cultivating these qualities during our life, and just trying to practice them, trying to be that way as much as we can during our life. That's a good preparation for death. And in fact, Lama Zopa Rinpoche has said that thinking of others, wishing them to be happy and free from suffering, these are the best thoughts and feelings that we could have in our life before death and during death. So that's answering your question. What is the best thing to have in the mind as we are dying? The best thing would be to think of others and feel kindness and compassion for others. But if, you know, if we wait till the last minute and then, you know, try to learn how to have love and compassion, it's probably not going to be too successful. So that's why it's important to start now. Start working on this now as much as we can. And, you know, it doesn't mean having to do it in a big way, you know, like Mother Teresa. We don't have to go around and pick up homeless people off the streets. And of course, if we can, that's wonderful. But, you know, even just working with our family and friends, the people we already interact with on a daily basis, and just trying to be kind and compassionate to them as much as we can, and your pets, your puppies, your kittens, your goldfish, you know, just showing kindness to the beings around you as much as you can. So that's a start. And then, you know, even with strangers, just trying to be friendly, smiling, try to be attentive if they need help. Sometimes there's opportunities to help people if we just keep our eyes open. And We're just doing as much as we can, even if it's just a little bit every day. Okay, and what's next? Okay, so then this is more Buddhist practices. So for those of you who feel comfortable and inclined towards Buddhism, there's the practice of taking refuge. Taking refuge means, ideally you know something about the Buddha and his teachings. You've studied, you've learned, you've thought about it. And if you come to the point where you feel, this is what I want to do. I really like this path. I want to follow this path. I want to follow and take the Buddha as my guide and follow his teachings. So on the basis of having really thought about this carefully, you come to the point of deciding this is what you want to do, then that's the meaning of taking refuge. Taking refuge is making a kind of commitment to following the Buddha and his teachings. But taking refuge is also something we do on a daily basis. Once you do take that step, deciding that you want to follow the Buddhist path, ideally we should take refuge every day, just reminding ourselves that this is what we're doing with our life. You know, I'm a Buddhist refugee, meaning, you know, I'm someone who, not in that sense, not like we've tried to escape from our country and gone to some other country, not like that, but, you know, that we are, you know, under the Buddhist guidance, we've made that decision to follow the Buddhist teachings. That's basically what it means. But we need to continue that. And it's not that you just take refuge one day and then that's it. It's something we need to do on a daily basis and then try to live our life, you know, as much as possible in accordance with the Buddha's teachings. So this can be very helpful at the time of death, because I think it's natural that we feel frightened and maybe a bit lost and worried what's going to happen to me, where will I go? So it can be very comforting to have a feeling of connection with one or at least one of the different Buddha figures. For many people, it could be Amitabha Buddha, or of course Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, the original founder of the Buddha. But many people, especially in the Chinese tradition, feel very connected with Amitabha Buddha, and Amitabha is Pure Land. So many people do that kind of practice, praying to Amitabha, reciting Amitabha's name, mantra, praying to be born in Amitabha's Pure Land. Other people feel very connected with Kuan Yin. This is the Chinese version of Kuan Yin, but we have also the Tibetan version of Kuan Yin. So we feel more connected with that deity. Medicine Buddha is another very popular one. And in fact, Lama Sopa Rinpoche has said that medicine Buddha practice is the best thing to do before dying, during dying, and after dying. So for example, if you're with somebody who is dying, that's what he recommends to do, medicine Buddha practice. Because it's not just for healing sickness, but it's also for clearing obstacles and making things conducive. But you could do it for yourself as well. So I think any of the Buddhist deities is good to do. So you may, like I say, you may feel naturally connected with one of the deity more than others. Other people feel very connected with Tara, female form of the Buddha. So whatever deity you feel very strongly connected with, then it's good to focus on that practice. And then that practice is something that can be helpful at the time of death, to be able to think of that Buddha image or Buddha figure, feel that they are there, present, and helping you, guiding you, and so on. So for many, that kind of practice may not work for everyone. Some people are more devotional in nature than others. But for some people, this is a method that gives a lot of comfort. And also even like before we die, whenever we face some difficulty, sickness, or if you feel like you're in danger, or you feel lost and confused and don't know what to do, and it's also very helpful to think of one of the Buddhas, pray to them, ask for help and guidance, and so on. And there's also mantras connected with many of these Buddhas, such as Om Mani Padme Hum. So to be able to do this at the time of death, it's good to get some experience while we're still alive. Something else that can help us to prepare for death is to study spiritual teachings. So again, everybody has different abilities. Some people can really go into depth with studying the sutras, the commentaries, and so on and so forth, the whole Lamrim. So if you're able to do that and really gain a lot of knowledge about the spiritual path and all the details of that and so forth, that could be very helpful. But not everyone has that much time, not everyone has that much ability or interest. But one thing that can be very helpful, I know some people do this, is they'll have a book, a spiritual book. Could be something from the Buddha's own teachings or something from a more contemporary teacher, Dalai Lama, for example, or Lama Zopa Rinpoche. They'll just have this book, and then every day, maybe before going to bed, they'll read one or two or three pages just to, you know, bring into their mind the wisdom, the knowledge of that spiritual teacher. And so that is very helpful. It's like, you know, increasing your knowledge, your awareness of spiritual teachings and spiritual practices. And then when we find ourselves at the time of death or, you know, in other difficult circumstances, some of those teachings might just pop up in our mind. We'll remember, oh, His Holiness said such and such, Thich Nhat Hanh said such and such, Jesus said such and such. So those teachings, it's like we've planted seeds there in our mind, and then those seeds will ripen at times of need, at times of difficulty, giving us answers, helping us to know what to do at that point in time. And yeah, they just help us to have more wisdom, more love, kindness, compassion, and less self-centeredness and anger and so forth. Okay, so then this is a teaching coming from the mind training tradition, which I talked about two weekends ago. So there's one text called the 7-Point Mind Training by Geshe Chikawa. And in that text, he mentions five powers that are, ideally, you practice them and familiarize with them during your life. And then at the time of death, you know, you can continue practicing these. So we don't have too much time, but I'll just quickly go through these, and whatever I don't cover today, I can finish tomorrow. Okay, so the first of the five is called the power of the white seed. So this means at the time of death to do virtuous things. White seed means plant virtue, plant virtuous seeds in your mind. So things you can do at that time would be to give away your things. You know, you don't need these things anymore. You're leaving behind. You're leaving all those things behind. So give them away. Give them away to others, or make offerings of them to the three jewels, for example, to a monastery, to your teacher, and so on. So that's something virtuous you can do at the time of death. Do some meditation, taking refuge in the three jewels. Generate positive thoughts in your mind. So even as you're dying, you know, you can still do things that are positive, that are virtuous, and this is planting good seeds in your mind that will enable you to have a good rebirth, good experiences in your next life. And then number two, the power of intention. So this teaching, mind training, is really all about bodhicitta, how to develop love and compassion and the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. So it's really geared towards people who have that kind of an inclination. So the power of intention means reaffirming your wish to work for enlightenment, to benefit all living beings. So remember that and make strong prayers and aspirations that whatever happens, wherever you go, wherever you're born and so on, you will be able to continue to cultivate these same qualities and continue to work towards enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So making that intention or that motivation really, really strong. And also, you know, having the intention that you will work against the negative states of mind, such as anger and hatred, harmfulness, self-centeredness, and so on. Yeah. So it says, for example, to have this thought in your mind, no matter what happens, may I always have love and compassion for all beings. May I use whatever experience happens to me to get closer to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So basically it means, you know, reaffirming your intention to work for the benefit of others, to work for enlightenment, to help all living beings. And then the third is the power of countering negativity. So So at the time of death, it's quite possible for negative states of mind to come up, such as anger, irritation, you know, when you're uncomfortable. I know this with myself, you know, when I'm in pain or uncomfortable, it's very easy for the mind to become bad-tempered. It's very hard to stay positive, you know, when things aren't going well. So it's quite risky at that point in time, you know, to keep your mind positive and avoid negativity. So you have to have a very strong determination that sees the disadvantages of negative states of mind, anger and jealousy and greed and so forth. So be very clear about that, and then really work hard to not let your mind be overcome by or taken over by negative states of mind. And hopefully you've already trained in ways of doing that, ways of counteracting negative states of mind and developing positive states of mind. So really try hard to do that. And also to do purification. So what I've heard with Tibetan lamas, for example, before they're dying, they'll do purification practices to, you know, try to clear up whatever negative karma they have created or vows that they've broken, so their mind is as clean, clear as possible as they're passing away from this life. And then the power of prayer. So at that point in time, it's good to make strong prayers about what you wish to do, you know, to always be in a situation where you can help others and not harm others, continue to work on your know, development of bodhicitta, work towards enlightenment, and so on. Pray to be born in a good situation, as in a pure land, or wherever you will be able to continue helping others. And what the lamas often recommend is, for example, Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, you know, we can pray that whatever suffering we do experience as we are dying, that we take on this suffering for the benefit of others. So there's this practice where you think, whatever suffering I'm experiencing, may this enable all beings to be free of their suffering. And that's really helpful. It's helpful, of course, because it's a very positive, virtuous thing to do. But it also gives meaning to suffering, you know, instead of the suffering being just horrible and meaningless, right? You're seeing some meaning, some benefit even, in going through this suffering. So that gives you a certain amount of peace of mind, a certain comfort of mind. Yeah, does that make sense? Like, not long ago, a friend of mine had to go through an operation for hernia, I think, and before the operation, he asked his teacher, "What should I do?" The teacher said, "Just pray that whatever suffering you go through, whatever suffering you experience, you're doing it for the benefit of all beings, for them to be free of their suffering." So he did that really, really hard. He said he was just kind of blissful, even though it was painful. Of course, there was pain. But mentally, you know, his mind was in a really peaceful and positive state. So even if there's physical pain, there can still be mental peace and some kind of, yeah, happiness. And of course, it's very virtuous to do that as well. And then number five, last one, is the power of familiarity. So this is just kind of a fact of life, or at least a fact of the way that our mind works. Whatever we are most familiar with, most habituated to, is what will come up most easily and naturally. So if we are familiar with or habituated to anger, getting angry a lot, complaining and blaming and criticizing and so on and so forth, if that's a habit that we've fallen into and we do again and again and again, then that's what's going to come up more easily and habitually in our mind. On the other hand, if we make ourselves familiar with kindness, compassion, thinking about others, wanting to help others, wanting to not harm others, so if that's something we are familiar with, that's what will come up most easily, most naturally. They even talk about this in terms of brain science as well, neural pathways, right? So we create these neural pathways by doing the same things or thinking the same things again and again and again. And then the more you do it, the more that will just come up naturally and habitually. So if you understand that and if that makes sense, then again, if we want to have positive thoughts and experiences as we are dying, we have to be familiar with those now while we are alive. Okay, so think about that. Ask yourself, what kind of thoughts and feelings do I want to have in my mind as I'm dying? Once you have that very clear in your mind, then okay, that's what I need to work on now, as much as I can. Okay. So tomorrow we'll go on to look at how to help others who are dying. But I mean, there's a lot more that could be said about this, but this is just some ideas. And there's actually a lot of books nowadays on this whole topic of death and dying and preparing ourselves for death, helping others who are dying. This topic has really come out of the closet. It used to be a real taboo subject, 20, 30, 40 years ago, nobody wanted to talk about death. They were, you know, very difficult to find any books about death and dying, but that's really changed a lot, which is fantastic. Cause, I mean, it's something we all have to go through in our life, and it's kind of crazy that, you know, nobody wanted to talk about it or hear about it or think about it. So any last questions before we finish? Yes?
Hi, thank you very much for your teaching. So today we learned that during the process of death, we can actually have certain practices to help us die more peacefully. And some of us might do the five powers, and some high practitioner might do the clear light of mind meditation. But what happens during death is that our body is not within our control, and there may be many things happening. For example, autopsy, or even doctors taking our organs for donation. Especially in Singapore, we have this automatic donation thing. Things that have been done to our body affect our practices. Because medical death and our, you know, mind leaving the body might be a different track of processes. So we might be medically dead, but our mind is still in the body. So having our body being operated on, tear apart, move here and there, will that affect our practices in our mind?
This is a hot topic.
Sorry about it.
There's different, I've heard different things about this. In some places, in some situations, it might be possible for the body to be left alone and undisturbed until the signs of actual death have occurred. And that would be the best thing, you know. And that's what they usually do with lamas or practitioners. They just leave them undisturbed. Sometimes that could go on for days or even weeks, you know, until the consciousness has actually left the body. In Singapore, that's probably not possible unless the person is at home and you can, you know, just keep things quiet and not call the doctor, not call anybody, you know, just, I don't know. It's possible. It's possible. But then on the other hand, if the person is in the hospital, then, you know, the hospital has its rules and, you know, you may not be able to leave a body undisturbed. I think they do allow it for 8 hours, as far as I know, that you know, because of the Chinese Buddhist beliefs and practices. It's possible to keep the body undisturbed for 8 hours. That's pretty long. So... And then this thing about organ donation, I don't know. Does that mean, are you saying that as soon as a person stops breathing, they'll automatically start removing organs without any choice? Because in other countries, you have to express your wish about that. They won't automatically remove organs unless you have already donated them. So every country has their own laws about that. But anyway, what I heard from one teacher, I don't remember who this was, but the thing about disturbing the body, like cutting into the body before the consciousness may have left, that's only a problem if the mind, the mental state, was kind of in a neutral state when they died. And it could, cutting into the body could disturb the mind and cause them to go into a negative state of mind, and then that would be unfortunate. On the other hand, if a person has decided to donate their organs, if they said, I really want to help somebody else live longer, so please take my organs, my eyes, whatever, they really sincerely made that decision, made that donation, that's such a positive state of mind, such a virtuous state of mind, that there isn't need to be concerned about their mind going to a bad place. That's one explanation of that. But I know there are different points of view. Some teachers, some lamas would say, no, don't let them cut into you. That's going to damage the death process and so on and so forth. So it's not an easy answer. And I would think that someone who really is a highly qualified practitioner who's able to, you know, be in the meditative state and work with a clear light and so on, that person would probably be in a very special situation where they would be able to avoid having their, you know, death process disturbed. So all we can do is just try our best to keep our mind as positive as we can during our life, cultivate our spiritual practice to the best of our ability so that we have a greater chance of having a strong state of mind, a strong abidance in a spiritual state of mind as we are dying. Because we just never know where we're going to be, what will the circumstances be at the time of our death. So just practice as much as we can now. That's all we can do. Okay, so if there are other questions, we'll take care of them tomorrow. And then again, tomorrow the session will be just in the morning from 10 to 12. So we'll end at 12 because later in the day there's a Guru Puja, because tomorrow is Lama Tsongkhapa's anniversary. It's a special day for making offerings and prayers, so everyone is welcome to attend that. And also I wanted to say that with regard, you know, in the previous talks and courses and so on, people have been very generous making offerings, red packets and so on. And whatever offerings are given this weekend, I'm going to give to Amitabha Buddhist Center. So first of all, you don't really have to give offerings. That's totally optional. It's up to you. But if you do want to give offerings, you can either put them here on the table or you can just put them directly into the donation boxes, because either way, they're going to go to Amitabha Buddhist Center, because ABC does a lot of wonderful work and they do need funds to be able to continue doing all their wonderful work. Okay, thank you very much and see you tomorrow. Oh, wait, we haven't got dedicate. Okay, let's just take a few minutes to make a dedication of all the merit, the positive energy that we've created today, coming together with a good intention, good motivation, wanting to bring benefit, peace, happiness to ourselves and to others and to the world. And then listening, thinking about, meditating on all these teachings. So this has been a really good thing to do. We've created good energy, merit. So now let's share this merit with others, all living beings, wishing it will bring them peace and happiness, freedom from suffering, and ultimately enlightenment. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Venerable. So for those of you who may not know, we actually have a Dover Park Hospice group, which is helping those who are only